This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. Before I get to my guest, who is the amazing writer, Devi Laskar, I want to share a little update on the podcast, and thank you for listening. First, I'm happy to say that this episode is the second one in my 7th year of hosting and producing First Draft. My 6th anniversary was earlier this month in June 2019, and I'm so grateful and humbled by all of you who have listened over the years. I started this show with an idea to talk to authors about their most recent published work, and it has grown, if I say so myself, into an incredible archive of interviews that highlight both the craft of writing and the themes the writers are exploring in their work. I have committed to conducting at least 40 interviews a year, but I've tended to hover around 45 to 48, meaning basically I read a book a week all year. Until 2 months ago, I was funded by Aspen Public Radio. That funding has ended, but I'm committed to continuing this show. I love doing it, and I hope you love listening. It's not an easy task to research potential guests, book them on the show, read their work, prepare for the interview, edit the content, and get it on the air. It takes time, money, and dogged determination to keep up with this. This podcast also requires resources in terms of equipment, hosting services, and time. So if you enjoy this podcast, I have 4 requests. First, please keep listening. I love having you out there. Second, invite a friend or two to subscribe. Third, please rate this podcast on iTunes. It helps me get new listeners. And fourth, please consider donating to keep this podcast going at www.patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. That's patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Every donation counts in building a community of listeners. And for your donations, I'm offering various gifts, which include extras from the interviews that aren't on this episode, writing tips from authors, books sent right to your door, cuts from the interviews. Similar to public radio, every donation counts and will help keep the show on the air. My goal is to secure other resources of funding within the next year. In the meantime, please know your patronage on all levels, from being a listener, a rater, and a donor, matters so much, and I couldn't do it without you. So thank you for tuning in. My guest today is poet and fiction writer Devi Laskar. Her novel is called The Atlas of Reds and Blues, which tells the story of a Bengali-American family living in Georgia. The narrator, only known as Mother, has been shot by the police in a raid on her home that was racially motivated. The novel is a kaleidoscopic view of Mother's own childhood, her career as a journalist, her marriage to a white man who is often traveling, and her experience of mothering 3 children. Looming ever present in the narrative is the racism she and her children face at school, in their neighborhood, and even in their own home via police invasion for being Bengali American. The Atlas of Reds and Blues is told via flashback in poetic-like structure. The novel is a meditation about what it means to be other in America and how it feels from the inside. We began our discussion with Devi Laskar sharing how she began writing the novel.
You know, when I first started to write this story, it was a family story. And the book I hold is like the gold standard of books, is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. And the reason why I hold it so dear to my heart is because she's a poet who wrote a novel. And if you take all the beautiful chapters of that book and put it together, it forms the novel. And yet, many of the individual parts of that book are heavily anthologized in poetry anthologies. And so I wanted to write something like that. So I wrote a family story, and I took it to Squaw Valley, and it was well received. And then I made it much longer and bigger. And then unfortunately, in 2010, my husband was racially targeted by his former employer in Georgia. And the state police did come to my house and raid my house at gunpoint. And among the things that they took was my computer. So I lost most of my work. And so I sort of had to start over, and it took me a long time. By the time I was able to start this book over, it was 2014. And I really loved still the small chapters and the quick pace of the book. I used to be a reporter and I am a poet, so I've had years of people telling me to make it shorter, and I really wanted to keep the short chapters, so I started with that. But what I did find was that the raid became the contextual glue of the book, and that's how it changed. It stopped being strictly a family story, and it took on different meaning and different layers for me, because I really wanted to explore more the racism and the misogyny and what it meant to be other and invisible in America.
It's so heartbreaking that you went through that experience, and especially, not especially, there's no especially, it's awful no matter what, but that it came from someone that you knew. And how did you heal or reckon with that? How did it, you know, it must have impacted every cell of your being.
It did. You know, the first year after the raid, I wasn't doing much writing, sort of corralling the family and trying to get our life back into some kind of semblance of order. But then in June of 2011, I tried to sit down and write, and I found that I couldn't. It was just not possible. And so I had a really good friend in Atlanta, and she made me go watch Julie and Julia. So for those who don't know, it's the true life story of Julie Powell. She gave herself a constraint. She had to cook every recipe out of Julia Child's famous cookbook within the year. And I am a photographer too. And so my friend said, you know, you take pictures, you should post them online so we can all hold you accountable, and you should caption your pictures. Because the minute you caption them or title them, then, and you do this as a practice, your words will come back. And she was right. So I started on June 23rd, 2011, and I do it to this day. And I take at least one photograph a day, and I caption it and I post it. And within a year, my poetry came back, which was great. And then 3 years later, the prose came back. And so I was able to get my words back. And then I was able to write the story. And I won't say it was cathartic, because I don't actually believe in catharsis through writing. I think what it did help me do was I really changed as a person, and I changed as a writer, and writing this book helped me demonstrate the change and hopefully pass that on to the reader.
Did you have any trepidation at all about writing this in terms of your immediate family, who also suffered the injustice of this? Like, was there any fear that they would relive it in some way, or did you talk to them about it before you wrote it?
I actually talked to them about it as I was writing it a little bit, but mostly when I was done. As I was editing it, and in that summer, last summer, I went to Tin House workshops in Portland, and some of my workshop hero teachers, they gave these really interesting talks about accountability and accountability to your network and to your community and to your family. And so at that point, I gave the book to my immediate family, my kids and my husband, and also to my sibling and his family. And I just let them read it, and I gave them complete authority, you know, to, like, if there's something in there that you don't like or you think is inappropriate, then this is your moment to tell me so I can take it out. And I'm really happy to report that everyone was just super proud and supportive, and I didn't cut a single word.
So let's talk about the book. You know, it takes place over one day, and Mother is the narrator. Can you tell me about your decision not to name any of the main characters?
There's two reasons why the family is not named. So I'm Bengali. And in my family and in my community, no one calls each other by their given names. We all have relational titles. So I really wanted to pay homage to that. So that's one of the reasons why I decided that they should all have relational titles and have no names. But the other reason is I wrote a book about, you know, being invisible and being othered in America. So in the world of the story, there was no point in me giving the narrator or her family names because no one in their world knows their name or cares to learn it or cares to remember it. And so it was really important for me to also kind of stick to that where she could not be really named because she kind of stands in for everybody who is ignored or othered in this country.
One of the things that, especially as a white reader, that this novel makes me so hyper aware of is all the sort of microaggressions and little instances of living as a brown person in this white culture. And some of the things that the narrator says is she talks about what it means to be truly invisible in the world.
So what I did want to show is that, you know, there are instances, I think, where it's very hurtful and someone says something where you're not really expecting it at that moment. You know, for example, you're not really expecting microaggression at the grocery store, but that's where it sometimes happens. Or you're not really expecting it when you're dropping off clothes at the dry cleaners. You know, that's a task that a lot of people do, and you just don't expect something rude to be happening at that moment. And I personally have gone through some of those kinds of moments, and I've seen other people go through it. And I just know the feeling, you know, that feeling where, you know, they don't see me. I'm invisible. But also, if they do see me, they just see me as someone so unlike them. There's no empathy. There's no understanding. And so I might as well not be there. And I wanted to kind of convey that because I feel like, especially these days in the current political climate, you know, there are a lot of people who feel othered and invisible and who feel unheard. And I wanted to just share that feeling. That's one of the reasons why I put the raid in. No, I was not shot, but I had my narrator be shot because one of the things, you know, I realize is that, you know, it is a literary conceit to say that you have a life flashing before your eyes narrative, but it is also somewhat true that when a policeman is pointing his assault rifle at you, that you think about your life very quickly and you think about what's important. And I wanted to convey that through my narrator because I feel like everyone goes through something really hard in their lives, whether or not it rises to the occasion of the evening news. And everyone knows that feeling of when something's going wrong and you're trying to kind of take stock of the beauty and the importance of the relationships in your life and the beauty in your life in case you don't have a chance to do it again. And that was sort of what I was hoping for.
I think something that comes across, too, is the ways in which she has to protect her children. They come home with tales of maybe being dragged across the playground or being told that, you know, maybe someone won't marry them. Or basically, she has to teach her kids what she calls a stiff upper lip game.
A little bit of that story is true. I did have one of my kids did have a bad experience at school. And, you know, she was just young enough where we played a lot of different games. We played word games and board games and she was just that age. And so, you know, we did play the stiff upper lip game. I was like, well, you know, what do you think we should do about this? And we kind of talked it out. And I didn't call it that in real life, but when I had to name it, you know, I was like, oh, well, you know, because I remember when we were playing that game and talking about it, her real life experience, you know, I had a fake British accent and she thought that was funny. And so I just wanted to kind of remember that in the story. And it also goes to that thing where, you know, mothers of color are, you know, concerned, especially these days when their children go out into the world, because we just don't know if they're going to stay safe.
She's experienced a lot of loss. Her beloved dog is dying. She suffered from a miscarriage. She, you know, has to kind of deal with indignities at work. And she is married to a white man that she calls her hero. But it seems like a very complicated marriage because it's not even the race difference so much as their approach to race. He's kind of more willing, I thought, from my read, to be more gracious. And that means for him maybe not speaking up in indignities. And he's also not home a lot. So she's bearing the burden of this family.
So this book was much longer originally. It actually went past the day of the raid. And what I realized was that I can't have it go past the day of the raid because it stops being her story. And I was really determined, especially the second time around in 2014, that her story be the story and her experience be the lens with which we all get to see their lives. And so there was a lot more of the hero in the story, but he was sort of hogging up space. So I had to kind of scale him back because I really wanted this to be her story. Here is a narrator who doesn't normally get to speak. And so I was just going to be giving her all the stage time she wanted. And so so that's how it naturally came that his presence is less in the story because I didn't want him to take over her space. And then the other reason that I sort of gave him his moniker and had him coming in and out that way is, you know, he is away. He is the primary breadwinner. He is away. They do have a pretty good marriage, but, and he does come and fix things. So that's sort of one of the conceits of the book is that, well, he comes back in time all throughout the book and fixes things. So the ending is unclear whether he makes it back in time, right? It's ambiguous and it's done on purpose because maybe this is one of the things he can't fix, but we just don't know. But I feel like I gave enough breadcrumbs so people can read it and kind of make up their minds. But I didn't want to be overt in saying something.
There was many of your character's childhood touchstones from the 70s, and one was the Barbie doll. And you talked a lot about the Barbie doll, the white Barbie doll, the introduction of the Barbie doll, the Barbie doll in Japan. And did you have Barbies, or was this more of an icon for you?
So I have a little story about the Barbies. So my dad was an academic, and so I had this great privilege when I was growing up. I grew up in the United States, but we would go back to India in the summers. And one year, my dad did a sabbatical in Germany, and so we were in Europe. And everywhere we went, you know, over the years, especially in the 70s, people would ask us, you know, where are you from? And I would say, America. And then they would, you know, this was the 70s. And so in their minds, America represented Barbie dolls and Coca-Cola. And in their mind, you know, people would say, oh, everyone there must have like hundreds of Barbie dolls. And you must turn on your kitchen tap and Coca-Cola must come out. You know, and so I was really interested in kind of doing a little deep dive in the book about the iconic nature of Barbie dolls. That's how the outside world, that's what the rest of the world thinks of America, as I think, at least back then when I was growing up, is like, they think that we all have dolls and we drink Coke all the time. And I didn't have too many. I had one or two. They didn't last long. My mom wasn't a big fan, but also I've come to find that I am not actually a big fan, and I wasn't really big on giving them to my own kids either. I feel like they represent something not so good. You know, they represent impossible standard of beauty. They represent, you know, they're anatomically incorrect. No matter what you do, you'll never look like that. And someone who looks like me will never look like that. And they also, you know, they set a tone for like women are supposed to be like this, and they're supposed to be silent, and they're supposed to be doll-like. And I didn't care for that. I have daughters, and I didn't want them to play with dolls that set such a bad tone.
One of the things that your novel does is it kind of blends time, because it almost has like a dreamlike quality. And it makes sense that you're a poet, because it is very poetic. It's not like a standard plot-based fictional novel that might just tell a story from beginning to end.
So when I turned this manuscript in, I had at the top of each chapter, I had the ampersand, which still remains, but I also had dates. I had years where each of the chapters took place. And Jenny was not having it. She found that that was too easy for the reader. And she wanted me to take all the dates out and rewrite them into the body of the chapters. So I got to write 200 new sentences. But she wanted me to do that because she wanted the readers to be sort of lost in the dream of the book, but also she didn't want them to be sure what year they were in, because she wanted them to think hard whether this was this act of microaggression or racism was current, or whether this was something that the mother narrator experienced as a child, or both. And I think that helped, you know, I think that really helped. By taking the dates out, I think it enmeshed the chapters more, so that you weren't sure whether it was happening in the past or in the present. And then as for the structure, I belong to this writing group, and I have for many years. And one of the people I work with is a screenwriter, and screenwriters use Aristotle's Incline, as their structure for writing scripts for movies. And so I thought that structure was brilliant and very appropriate for my narrator, because she doesn't have 50 pages to muse on anything. It's a very short novel because she has a very short amount of time to think about her life. And so I borrowed the Aristotle's Incline structure, and it worked well for my mother narrator. I thought it was appropriate.
Can you read a section from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Yes. So I have to say, I looked high and low this morning and had many choices, but the one I'm going to go with is a section from Citizen by Claudia Rankine. In any case, Youngman doesn't speak to this kind of anger. He doesn't say that witnessing the expression of this more ordinary and daily anger might make the witness believe that a person is insane. And insane is what you think one Sunday afternoon, drinking an Arnold Palmer, watching the 2009 Women's U.S. Open semifinal, when brought to full attention by the suddenly explosive behavior of Serena Williams. Serena in HD before your eyes becomes overcome by a rage you recognize and have been taught to hold at a distance for your own good. Serena's behavior on this particular Sunday afternoon suggests that all the injustice she has played through all the years of her illustrious career flashes before her, and she decides finally to respond to all of it with a string of invectives. Nothing, not even the repetition of negations, no, 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 she employed in a similar situation years before as a younger player at the 2004 U.S. Open, prepares you for this. Oh my God, she's gone crazy, you say to no one. What does a victorious or defeated Black woman's body in a historically white space look like? Serena and her big sister, Venus Williams, brought to mind Zora Neale Hurston's "I feel most colored when I am thrown against a sharp white background." This appropriated line, stenciled on canvas by Gwen Ligon, who used plastic letter stencils, smudging oil sticks, and graphite to transform the words into abstractions, seemed to be ad copy for some aspect of life for all Black bodies.
Tell me more about why you chose that.
So, you know, when I was writing this book again for the second time in 2014, I was sort of thinking in my head about Sandra Cisneros' book, and then Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, came out, and I felt like I got handed a permission slip to write about race. And I just was so obsessed with this book, but also it just sort of overtook my life. And I think I bought and gave away this book as gifts, you know, 24 times over when the book first came out. I was just so relieved that someone had written a book like this, and that now I could have, I could do it too. That I sort of gave me a little courage, and for that I am always grateful.
Can you read a passage from something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft.
In her dream, she is back at the butterfly house with her hero, not too long after they return from their grand wedding in India. The Fritillary garden is a hothouse, a greenhouse with clear glass cathedral ceilings, and they stand in silence, in awe, fingers entwined, taking in the cluster of monarchs and what looks like stained glass wings, only they're alive. The telephone rings in this dream because in the real life upon which the dream is based, the telephone really does ring at the desk in the hallway of the annex to the hothouse. It is a shrill clanging, not unlike the sound of an alarm at a firehouse, and the beautiful orange is replaced by emergency red, the red of the fire engines in the nearby station house, the red ink from her teacher, Sister Joan, who gave her a D in the mandatory religion class in fifth grade because she couldn't abide a non-Catholic topping the class.
And tell me more about that.
So this is one of the chapters that I moved around quite a bit. And I had it way back in the beginning of the book, and then I had it way at the end. And it didn't belong in either of those places. And this is one of the chapters that when I finally did read it aloud to myself, I realized that it didn't belong there and I had to go find a home for it. And also, this was one of the chapters that is sort of a composite of three different chapters that I had to collapse because they weren't standing very well on their own. And so I ended up putting them together and rewriting it a couple of times. And then I'm happy to say I found its home.
Where do you write?
I write prose at my desk in my little office in my house. I write poetry everywhere, but for the novel, I stick pretty close to my desk, and I'm usually writing on the computer, but sometimes I write longhand, but still sitting at my desk.
And what do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I hope I never get away from writing. I'm just so grateful I'm able to write these days. And we did rescue a little dog last year. And so these days, for sure, when I need a break and I want to think about something, we go on long walks. And I still think about my writing, but I'm not chained to the desk. So it's wonderful.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I have a wonderful writing group, and there are a couple of old friends in that group who get to see my work in the early stages and get to tell me if things are working or not working, and I value their opinions very much.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Gee, not very well. I've gotten better. In the beginning, I think when I was an early poet, I was rejected all the time and I was very discouraged. But now I am grateful when someone doesn't take something because I feel like they're trying to tell me that it's not quite there, or it's not quite ready. And it's an indication of maybe I should rethink it and try again.
And what is your favorite word?
These days, my favorite word is incandescent. I just love how it sounds. It sounds like a spell and talks about light. And I think that's a wonderful word. It's a wonderful word to share in the world.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing. My guest was Debbie Lascar, author of The Atlas of Reds and Blues. Our interview was recorded at Aspen Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. Thanks so much for tuning in. As a reminder, please consider supporting First Draft at www.patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Your support matters and will help keep this podcast going. So far, there are 242 authors in the archive, with more coming soon. Thanks for your contributions, and please don't forget to rate First Draft on iTunes. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks again for listening and supporting First Draft.